Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Pachinko Parlor by Eliza Sua Dusapan. Translated by Anissa Abbas Higgins. Narrated by Hannah Choi. I step out of the train and plunge into the narrow passageways of Shinagawa Station. Limescale on the walls, plasma screens flashing toothpaste ads, a woman with a gleaming smile, a tide of people rushing by. Outside, workmen are dismantling a building site. A platform overhangs a garden, cherry trees, enclosures where salarymen gather to smoke, puffing jerkily on their cigarettes, stubbing them out on rocks that look like the stones that horses lick for salt. I follow Madame Ogawa's directions. Take the walkway that leads to the residential complex, building number 4488. Buzz the answer phone to let her know I've arrived. Take the lift up to the top floor. The door opens directly into the apartment. Madame Ogawa is dressed in a tailored jacket, sweatpants, and socks. The heat is stifling. She looks older than I'd expected. Perhaps it's because she's so thin. She's sent her daughter, Mieko, on an errand to the shops. She'll show me round while we wait. A long corridor with rooms on either side, perfectly symmetrical. She shows me the bathroom first. Flesh-toned plastic, so tiny I can barely stand. The bedroom opposite is just as small. Built-in wardrobe, brown carpet. A bed with an immaculately ironed bedspread, a second one thrown across it, unironed, piled with a jumble of skirts and t-shirts. A stale tobacco smell hangs in the air. "This used to be a hotel," Madame Ogawa says apologetically. "We're on the smoking floor here. We moved in when the hotel went bankrupt. My husband's a bullet train engineer. He was working on the expansion of Shinagawa Station for the Shinkansen trains. The whole area is being redeveloped. This'll be a hotel again soon. They're supposed to start work later this month. We're the only ones living here." She's standing in the doorway, looking at me, her hand on the doorknob. I turn away, feeling uncomfortable in the intimacy of this cramped room with its bare light bulb. I can't see any windows. At the far end of the corridor, an open-plan living room with kitchen diner. The stove takes up most of the room, along with the bookshelves. Beyond the picture window, a haze of pollution blurs the contours of the metropolis below. I follow Madame Ogawa back toward the entrance. "Mieko's room is downstairs," she says, indicating a door half hidden by a coat rack. The door opens onto a concrete staircase. "Be careful," she says. "The light switch is at the bottom of the stairs." Her voice echoes slightly, as if in a cave. I feel my way down until the concrete gives way to a springier surface underfoot. The humidity rises. A neon light flickers on to reveal an open pit surrounded by a walkway with a waist-high glass barrier. The floor of the pit slopes gently down to a drainage hole. In one corner sits a single bed. Madame Ogawa places her hands on the guardrail. "The swimming pool. It's never been used, even when the hotel was open. Mold. It's clean now, since we had it drained. Mieko sleeps here, for the time being." I lean over the barrier to get a better look. Arranged around the bed, a desk and a chest of drawers, a yoga mat, and a hoop reflected to infinity in mirrors on either side of the pool. Plastic blocks are arranged at the foot of the steps leading down into the pool. I can't help thinking of the arcade game Tetris, with the geometrical shapes that drop down and have to be arranged in space. "Do you like yoga?" Madame Ogawa asks. I tell her I don't know, I've never tried it. She nods her head slowly. We go back upstairs. A little girl is waiting for us in the kitchen, bobbed hair, shorts, and a yellow t-shirt. She's sweating. Her fringe sticks to her forehead as she bows to greet me. "I bought salmon," she says to her mother, holding up a package of ready-made lasagna. It's only 10 in the morning, but Miyako starts setting the table while her mother shucks oysters and puts the lasagna in the microwave. It comes out steaming, and she serves large portions to Miyako and me, a smaller one for herself. She's taken off her jacket. Her t-shirt clings to her ribs, the points of her nipples. A vein bulges along her arm from shoulder to wrist. Desiccated, I think to myself, like everything else about her. The lasagna sheets slither off her chopsticks into the pink bechamel sauce. She fishes them out again deftly. From time to time, I bite into something that feels solid. The salmon, probably. Miyako finishes eating and leans back in her chair, her mouth opening and closing like a fish. Madame Ogawa dabs at her lips with her napkin, folds it back up.
If you could take her out once in a while, too.
Of course.
I was thinking, perhaps you could go and play first?
Okay. I'm not sure I've understood what she means by play. In Japanese, play can be used for all sorts of things, from children's games to evenings out with work colleagues. In Korean, too. I have no idea what children like to do. I'm in my late 20s. I'm not used to being around 10-year-olds. I'm beginning to wish I hadn't answered that ad. Native French speaker wanted in Tokyo to tutor 10-year-old during summer holidays. I'd seen the ad in Geneva on Tokyo's Sophia University website. Madame Ogawa was a French teacher herself. She'd be busy preparing for the next school year. She didn't want her daughter spending too much time on her own. I'd been planning to spend the month of August in Tokyo with my grandparents before traveling to Korea with them at the beginning of September. I was concerned I might have too much time on my hands. I accepted Madame Ogawa's offer, and we agreed that I'd meet up with Miyako now and then during my stay. Madame Ogawa cleans her plate and glances over at mine.
You don't like it. Have some oysters.
No, no, it's good, I say, forcing down a mouthful of lasagna. She clears away the lasagna plates, and Miyako places an oyster in front of me. The flesh retracts, a small, viscous lump. I take a deep breath and gulp it down. Madame Ogawa seems satisfied. She asks me where I'm staying.
Not far from here, I reply. 10 stations further north on the Yamanote line, at my grandparents' place.
I pause. I feel awkward talking about my grandparents in Japanese. It makes them seem foreign somehow. I carry on talking to compensate.
They're Korean, I say. They live in Nippori. They run a pachinko parlor there. It's only a small parlor. They've been running it for 50 years, ever since they arrived here.
Miyako leans in toward the table, her lips closed. Madame Ogawa nods, a look of concern on her face, just as when I said I didn't do yoga. I can understand her reservations. Here in Japan, pachinko machines are seen as no different from casino slot machines. Everyone plays pachinko, but it's still disapproved of. Pachinko parlors have their own banking system, with a reputation for funding the main political parties under the counter. They advertise all over the media, feeding a whole parallel economy. But that's only the big chains like Diamond or Merrytail, not small businesses like my grandfather's. When we finished eating, Madame Ogawa goes down to the pool, and Miyako sets her things out on the table.
Aren't we going down to your room? I ask.
No, my mother's there.
She calls me Sensei, teacher in Japanese. I tell her to call me by my name, Claire, but it's hard for her to say. She pronounces it Kalero, so I ask her to use the Korean for big sister, Onni.
Onni,
she murmurs, as if she's trying to commit it to memory. Her homework is clearly set out in a notebook. Today's topic is agreement of French adjectives. I'm not sure of her level, so I read the examples aloud for her, thinking what a dull textbook this is, colorless, with no pictures. Miyako knows it all perfectly, giving the answers before I can ask the questions. What's the point of me being here? I ask her.
We've practiced it, she says.
Practiced?
Yes, because you were coming.
I think back to the meal we've just had, how everything she and her mother did was perfectly synchronized. I watch her working through the exercises for a few moments and then leave her to get on with it. I walk over to the picture window, look down at the station, a central spine, four walkways fanning out like limbs, a lizard lying in wait, buildings everywhere, overhead wires stretching into the distance, all the way to Mount Fuji, barely visible through the smog. I scan the bookshelves, Rousseau, Chateaubriand, essays on literature, Swiss romantics, history books, the French Revolution. I have the feeling these books don't contain the history I learned at school. These volumes tell of another parallel history, one that played out simultaneously on another planet. Around 1 o'clock, Madame Ogawa comes back up with some royal milk tea and kwabegi, Korean donuts, from the Family Mart for us. The bodysuit she's wearing reveals every fold and pleat of her body. After she's gone back down, I ask Miyako why her mother wears shoes inside the apartment. Japanese people usually take them off indoors.
She says she needs to hear her own footsteps. I'm not supposed to tell anyone.
We sit side by side munching our snacks. The label on the bottle of tea has a picture of Donald Duck and Daisy in their swimsuits at the beach. A special summer offer. Of course, Disneyland Tokyo. I could take Miyako there. I'm not sure she'd like it. Maybe amusement parks aren't her thing. Is there anywhere in particular you'd like me to take you while I'm here? She looks up at the ceiling, then at me, goes to say something, hesitates, sits up straight, and eventually she says she doesn't really mind. It's up to me. I feel vaguely annoyed. You're not much help, I think to myself. When she's finished the worksheets, she asks me what she has to do next. I haven't prepared anything. I make up an excuse to keep her busy for a while. I'm still feeling jet-lagged. Sitting on the sofa, I have a hard time staying awake. There's not enough ventilation. The windows are steamed up. The room feels cramped. I'm bigger and bulkier than Miyako and her mother. If I'm not careful, I might break something. Walking me back to the lift, Madame Ogawa hands me an envelope and thanks me. She seems relieved that my visit is over. She's wearing a robe. Her hair is wet. I haven't said goodbye to Miyako. She hasn't finished the worksheet. But the door slides shut. I spend the train journey back to Nippori trying to dislodge a piece of kwabegi stuck between my teeth. By the time I manage to work it free, my tongue has started to bleed. I arrive at my grandparents' place to find my grandmother seated on the floor in the living room, surrounded by her Playmobil figures. She's removed all their hair. They smile vacantly.
Where have you been?
I don't answer, irritated by the whining tone she adopts whenever I come in. She knows perfectly well where I've been. She roots around in the pile of Playmobil wigs, pulls out one with a long braid and one with a bun, sets them on the heads of two female figures and holds them up to her ears, shaking them.
Which one do you like best? I have to go to the hairdresser's.
I take a good look at her. Long nose, rounded belly, like a baby seal. The bun.
Will you come with me?
I call out yes from the kitchen. I put some water on to boil for the rice, soak the black beans. We'll eat when my grandfather gets home, at 8:30, after the pachinko parlor closes. He's 90 years old, but he still goes every day, from dawn to dusk. I go back to the living room, open the window to let out the steam. Nippori. Pale green, to match the green of the Yamanote Line trains that slice through the neighborhood on their elevated rails. Korean restaurants, Chinese noodles, sumo stables,
the vast Yanaka Cemetery up on the hill, and the pachinko parlors, Diamond and Merrytail on the street that goes to Nishi Nippori, Shiny, my grandfather's, on the street leading to Uguisudani. Our duplex is wedged between two tower blocks, across the street from the Shiny. You can see it from the kitchen and living room windows, the gaudy front painted in red and white, like a clown's face. Now and then, the doors open to suck players in or spit them out with the smoke. Shiny. Not so shiny, though, especially when you compare it with the Diamond or Merrytail. To attract customers, my grandfather employs a sandwich board woman. She must be about my age. She stands on the corner by the taxi rank, at the foot of the steps leading up to the station, her two boards sporting the Shiny's colors clamped to her body. Her monotonous chant blends in with the piped music from the Family Mart, the convenience store next door, open 24 hours a day. And then there's Yuki, scrawny and round-shouldered, in his pink sweater, the professional player hired to stand outside the Shiny in the morning, waiting for it to come to life. As soon as the doors open, he makes straight for the machine nearest the window. The idea is to create an impression of plenty. Come in, his presence says. Inside the Shiny, things are buzzing. At the front desk, the security guard with his surveillance cameras. A local policeman, retired. The Japanese government doesn't provide pensions for its employees. Men without savings or family to look after them in their old age have to go on working until the end of their lives. There aren't many pachinko parlors that don't have a retired policeman in charge of security. We eat sitting on the floor at the low table in the living room. My grandfather raises his spoon slowly to his mouth, his hand shaking. Finally, he sucks in the contents in one gulp, as if the food he's carried so laboriously to his lips might evaporate. From time to time, he puts down his spoon and pours himself a glass of soju. He concentrates intently, his grip unsteady, but nothing spills. My grandmother leans over toward her bowl, slurping her food with gusto. She looks up occasionally and asks me in English, "Is good? Is good?" "Yeah, mashisoyo," I mumble in Korean. "Yes, it's good." I sit facing them, trying to eat as slowly as my grandfather, delaying that moment at the end of the meal when a heavy silence descends. They haven't mentioned our trip to Korea once since I arrived. We need to make plans, start buying tickets. I don't know how to raise the subject. I used to be able to speak Korean, but I lost it when French became my main language. My grandfather used to correct my mistakes, but not anymore. We communicate in simple English, with a few basic words in Korean and an array of gestures and exaggerated facial expressions. We never speak in Japanese. When they turn on the television, I feign tiredness and go downstairs to my room. The staircase is narrow, like the one at Miyako's, except that here the floors are made of wood, the walls covered in mustard-colored flock. My room is next to the bathroom. My grandparents use it to store bedding and extra tatami mats. When I was little, the rolled-up bamboo mats standing sentinel in the half-light would appear in my dreams, transformed into giant grasshoppers. The room is simply furnished. A bed, a desk, a few boxes of my mother's things. On top of one of the boxes is our old Monopoly set, the Swiss edition my mother bought to give her parents an idea of where we live. On the table by the bed is a photo of my grandmother, aged about 10, with plump cheeks and round belly, taken just before the Second World War. Her mother stands behind her, one hand on her shoulder. Dressed in the traditional white linen costume, they pose proudly. It was rare for women to have their picture taken in Seoul in those days. Over the years, the white of their costume has taken on a dull tinge, a yellowish hue that speaks of mourning in both Korea and Japan. I lie on the bed, wriggle out of my clothes. My feet protrude beyond the end of the bed. It's too hot. The polyester sheets cling to my stomach.
In the end, I unroll one of the tatami mats, cover it with a sheet, and lie on the ground, trying to find a cool spot. Noises drift in from the street, car exhausts, heels on the tarmac, and all night long, the sandwich board woman's monotonous chant, relayed on playback through a loudspeaker. The window is at street height. Lying on the ground, I can see people's legs as they hurry past, heading for the narrow streets of Uguisidani, where the love hotels are. I've never been inside one. I can't help thinking about the girls who work there, the men in gray suits. Most of the girls are much younger than I am. I picture the street. I know every inch of it. I've walked down it so often on my way to Ueno Park. The shawl, with its cut-out black bat on the roof, the transatlantic, the Mont Blanc with its jacuzzis, the dream. Further along, you come to the bento box stall with its panda-shaped scales, walk over the bridge above the railway lines, past the man in his makeshift canvas shelter, skirt along the cemetery as far as the whale statue in front of the Natural History Museum, and eventually arrive at Ueno Park. Starbucks, the University of the Arts, then the zoo. Through the ceiling, I hear my grandmother laughing. I open my laptop and check my emails. My friends gave up writing to me ages ago. I took too long to reply. Matthew probably has too weak a signal. He's house-sitting a chalet in Val d'Anniviers, writing up his thesis. And my mother? Has she messaged me? She usually keeps me up to date on where my father's been playing. He's an organist. She sends me lists of the churches, chapels, cathedrals he's played in. Pontoise, Zurich, Rheinau, Solothurn, Zollikon, Fribourg. She never gives me the program, only the venue. I picture them both. Dots on the map, hopping from town to village. How easy it seems for them. Ever since I came to Japan, I've felt drained of all energy. Sometimes when I read my mother's messages, I feel so exhausted I abandon whatever it was I was planning to do and stretch out on the bed, arms and legs spread like a starfish. She hasn't written. My laptop starts making a loud, whirring noise. I shut it down and become aware of the darkness, the silence in the house. I can't hear the television anymore, nor my grandmother's laugh, only the distant cry of the sandwich board woman. I close my eyes and let sleep wash over me. 3 days have gone by. I've changed my mind about taking Miyako to Disneyland. All children love places like that. I'd have gone there myself with my grandmother when I was Miyako's age, but my mother was against it. She didn't consider it appropriate. I head toward Nippori Station. It's rained in the night, a monsoon downpour, although Japan's monsoon season is supposed to be over. The temperature has stalled, several degrees above the average for this time of year. The sandwich board woman smells of wet clothes. Her boards are limp and waterlogged. She stepped back under the awning, out of the rain, but still visible from the sidewalk. Her hair is matted. She fixes her gaze straight ahead, the microphone in her hand. It's supposed to be attached to her cap. The elastic must have gone. I make a mental note to mention it to my grandfather. It's not quite time for my train. I go into the family mart, stop in front of the packaged pastries, try to get a clearer image of the contents obscured by the logos all over the packaging. I can see someone squinting at the yogurts in the chilled section. Pink sweater. Yuki. I ran into him here this morning, too. He comes in by the back entrance, through the glass door that connects with the shiny. Most players at this time of day are women. They come while their children are at school or on summer programs, and their husbands are at work. The older people, retirees, come mostly in the afternoon. Early in the evening, the machines are taken over by salarymen and sumo wrestlers. Yuki selects a choco mint donut and goes back to the shiny. The door slides open, a blast of loud music, rapid-fire salvos of pachinko balls. People say the name pachinko comes from the noise the balls make in the machine, pinging against the glass, swooshing through the plastic tubes, clanking against the bumpers, the shriek of metal, the final clang as they fall into the tray. The door slides shut. Silence. Yuki takes his seat at his usual machine, rips the wrapping from the donut, eats it with one hand, the other poised on the lever. He gazes out of the window. The rules are simple. The player sits in front of the upright pachinko machine and feeds money in. Balls come spurting up, thousands of metal balls, spraying, tumbling, and bouncing off a series of obstacles, all the way down to the bottom of the vertical playing field, then vanishing into one of three holes. Balls that fall into the middle hole come back out in a cart on the outside of the machine. Players can exchange them for prizes at the end of the session, the prize lots determined by the number of balls. The only control a player has over the machine is to adjust the force at which the balls are ejected by slowly turning a knob that fits into the palm of the hand. The knob turns both ways. There's not much else for players to do. Some jam the knob into position with a coin, leaving their hands free so they can smoke. The experienced players keep one hand on the handle. That way, they can stay in control, sense the slightest hitch, tweak the handle in response, or relax the fingers a little. The smallest of movements, almost imperceptible, can influence the outcome. They stay focused, ignoring the flashing lights, the other players, the cigarette burning down, the wail of the piped music, and the din of the 300 pachinko machines in my grandfather's gaming hall. At 8:15, I buy some plums and a couple of donuts, walk to the station, the sandwich board woman's cry in my ears. Shiny and bright, shiny and bright, shiny, shiny every night. Domed blue ceiling, a phantom ocean. The Little Mermaid hangs from a wire, waving her hands in greeting, her tail swishing sinuously in her wake. Her stomach bulges from the harness beneath her bodysuit. Down on the ground, visitors brandish cameras, contorting themselves to keep her in their sights. A puff of smoke, and Triton, king of the waves, surges forth. A robot, not a living actor like the mermaid. His voice booms out a warning to his daughter. Moray eels. Ariel screams, another puff of smoke. She spins one last time and disappears. Darkness. Outside, it's raining again.
Did you like that? I ask Miyako nervously.
Yes.
Minnie Mouse is handing out ponchos and pink umbrellas. People are starting to line the main street. Clustered all together, all swathed in plastic, they remind me of bubble wrap.
What are we waiting for?
I ask Miyako, realizing we've joined the expectant crowd.
A parade.
She's too far back to be able to see anything. Do you want to stand in front of me? I ask.
I don't mind.
I ask her what she'd like to do. She scans the scene. I suggest it's a small world. There's no line there at the moment. She pulls a face. What about the Haunted Mansion? Another grimace. Peter Pan's Flight?
Okay.
I suspect she's only saying yes to please me. Or something else, if you prefer.
No, that's fine.
We fly over London, the city set out beneath us, children's bedrooms, Big Ben displaying midnight. It's warm and clammy in our pirate ship. There's the smell of sweat. I try not to touch any surfaces. The seatbelt is loose on Miyako, even when it's pulled tight. I can't see the expression on her face. When we get to the pirate's island, I make a show of laughing at Captain Hook, oohing and aahing exaggeratedly until suddenly we pick up speed and I'm flung against Miyako. She turns and gives me a slightly condescending smile. For the rest of the ride, I cling to the edge of the seat. When we emerge, it's raining even harder. We wait it out.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?